The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Simon Woods, the Chief Executive Officer of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer, WNYM, in New York City.
It was an incredible declaration by the New York Times when it stated, and I quote, "The LA Philharmonic is the most important orchestra in America, period. It's also the orchestra that will be celebrating its centennial anniversary this year and doing so in a way that is befitting of that well-earned reputation above. And it's a pleasure to have with us tonight the CEO of the LA Philharmonic, Simon Woods." Good evening, Simon, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. Great pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I can't easily imagine Los Angeles having a Philharmonic Orchestra back in 1919, but it did. So on this occasion of your centennial, share with us some of the history of the L.A. Phil.
Well, the L.A. Phil was founded back in 100 years ago by William Andrews Clark, who was a remarkable philanthropist who loved music and felt that L.A., it was high time that L.A. had a great orchestra. And, the very early days of the L.A. Phil were interesting. There was the first performance in downtown L.A., but then there was some very famous performances out at the Hollywood Bowl. You see right from the very beginning of this organization this sort of inextricable link between the Hollywood Bowl and downtown L.A. and this desire to make a huge public impact. There's mm-hmm. a famous picture from the 1920s. Of what's called the Easter Morning Service, where William Andrews Clark brought together the LA Phil for this public Easter service in the Hollywood Bowl to start to play with and explore the beautiful natural acoustics of this wonderful special place, which has gone on to be a place that's deep in the heart of Angelenos. Mm-hmm. So the history is it's a beautiful thing, looking back right to the very beginning of the orchestra and watching the way it's evolved over the last 100 years.
It sure is, and I think it also had the freedom being out west like that, that it was not held captive to the institutions and the strictures of those Eastern orchestras. And as a result of that, you've always been in the forefront of innovation. And what are some of the firsts that the orchestra can lay claim to?
Well, in general, yes, I think in the West Coast, over the past couple of decades, especially, there has been this sense that this is where the most exciting work in American orchestras is going on, which isn't in any way to say anything negative about the many great orchestras in the East. But there's some different air that you breathe in the West. It's an air of that freedom to be who you are and to be unencumbered by tradition. Mm-hmm. And I think the LA Phil, through its history, has really capitalized on that to think differently about what it means to be an orchestra, what it means to be an orchestra in the 21st century. It is an organization which has always blended a great sense of continuity and tradition with a great sense of looking forward. And I'll give you one small example. If you go back to the 1970s, you find some really interesting things going on. You find that, for instance, the LA Phil was the one of the very first orchestras ever to start a program to encourage minority musicians mm-hmm. to find their way into music. Now, today, many orchestras have that. We have our own program around, building a pathway for musicians from, to communities who don't normally find their way into classical music. But the LA Phil was doing that back in the 1970s. The LA Phil was playing church concerts in African-American communities in Los Angeles back in the 1970s. It's always, to me, had this sense of being just, a few steps ahead of everybody else. And I think you can find that if you look back in its history.
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, it was really baked into the DNA of the organization.
Yeah.
It hired the first African-American mm-hmm. musician back in 1948. It invited the first woman to conduct in 1925.
Absolutely.
So it's just this long history that continues. I think for a lot of people around the country, they may know the LA Phil, the most from your dynamic and gifted conductor, Gustavo Dudamel.
Yeah.
And you've been around a lot of orchestras. You've led a lot of orchestras, both in this country and abroad. What would you say that makes Dudamel special?
Well, look, my whole career I've been, if you like, a kind of professional conductor watcher. Maybe it's because I'm a failed conductor myself. You know, I trained as a conductor, and so I've always loved and been fascinated by the art of conducting. It is a very, very mysterious thing. There is a magic that a great conductor can generate with an orchestra, which is unique to who that person is. And, you know, it's one of the most amazing things about orchestras is the way that they sound different with a different conductor. One conductor can stand in front of the orchestra and the orchestra will sound one way. And then purely because of their gestures, another conductor will step up and the orchestra will sound different. And I've, over the years, quizzed many musicians about this, and it's not entirely clear. I mean, there are things you can point to do with, you know, whether the gestures are hard or soft or how the conductor presents himself or how they talk. But the fact is, the conductor plays this extraordinary role in kind of molding the sound of the orchestra. So this is a very, very long answer to your question.
but it was a good setup.
about Gustavo Dudamel, because he is, in my experience in, you know, 30 years in this business, he is one of the most remarkable individuals that I have ever seen stand in front of an orchestra. Because he literally does have that kind of almost magic presence that enables him to conjure things and produce things from an orchestra that maybe they even themselves didn't think were possible.
That's greatness.
And it is greatness, and it's partly to do with who he is as a human being and his kind of very gracious but determined way of working together with musicians, not at them but with them. And it's partly to do with, you know, he is technically supreme. He mm-hmm. has an amazing technique and an amazing memory. So he conducts a lot of what he conducts from memory. No score in front of him. So he's very free to sort of communicate, you know, emotionally and instinctively with the orchestra. And it's also partly to do with the discipline of great training.
Mm-hmm.
So he not only has those special, if you like, magical skills that make him magnetic as an audience member to watch, but there is this bedrock of absolutely superb musicianship, which gives him this freedom, which is remarkable.
And he does all that in two extraordinary venues. We mentioned the Hollywood Bowl. Tell mm-hmm. us about that a little bit more, and also your other venue.
Well, Walt Disney Concert Hall, of course, in downtown Los Angeles, is one of the great, I really feel like it's one of the great music venues of the world. And, you know, in my just over a year in this organization, one of the things that's been wonderful for me has been that I've heard virtually every concert I've heard there, I felt like I was hearing the piece of music for the first time.
Mm.
Because Walt Disney Concert Hall, you know, designed by Frank Gehry with this amazing partnership between Frank and this incredible acoustician, Yasu Toyota, between them, Frank and Yasu created this space which has an amazing combination of properties that you don't always find in concert halls. It's warm, it's engaging, and it's detailed.
Mm.
So it's not only a very warm and sort of it's not only a beautiful warm bath of wonderful sound, very sensuous sound, but you really hear the detail in the music. You are able to listen inside the music, and so it makes a really compelling place to listen to music. And I have absolutely no doubt that this factor, the sheer quality of the hall, is like the third strand of our artistic success, with the other two being Gustavo Dudamel, of course, and the extraordinary quality of the orchestra. Mm. And I really see the hall as the third instrument. And it's if you know, our sales are remarkable. I mean, we're still, you know, 15, 16 years after the opening of the hall, 10 years into Gustavo Dudamel's tenure, we're still selling, you know, 90% of the tickets across the season. Gustavo's concerts are pretty much entirely sold out. And so I think it's this combination of great qualities that we have, like, all together. It's like a perfect
package.
Perfect package.
It really is.
And I didn't talk about the Hollywood Bowl, but the Hollywood Bowl, of course, is the alter ego, if you like, of the LA Field. And one of the things about the Hollywood Bowl that I've learned is just how beloved it is by our community. I mean, to go to the Hollywood Bowl, the number of times that people have said to me, "Oh, you know, my grandma used to bring me there on picnics. Oh, yeah, my dad brought me there as a kid. Oh, yes, our family used to go there. Oh, yes, that's where I had my first date with my wife." I mean, people have had many, many significant experiences there, and so it has tremendous affection in the hearts of the people of the whole region of Los Angeles County.
And that's your summer home, right?
Yeah, it's our summer home, and we're there all the way through the summer. And by the way, it's not only about the orchestra concerts we present there. It's about all the other concerts. It's about the jazz and the world music and mariachi evening and the K-pop evening and all the other amazing things that happen during the course of the summer.
Let me pick up on that a little bit, because the LA Philharmonic is quite unlike any other orchestra in that you have this uncanny knack to blend genres and styles and then come up with something completely new and distinctive, a new art form almost. Give us some examples where you've seen that work at its very best.
Well, I think one of the things that we've done, which has been extraordinarily successful over the years, is we've really explored Walt Disney Concert Hall as a performance space.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times a year in Walt Disney, the concerts we'll put on, it might be an opera, it might be a big piece of contemporary music, but you will see things beyond just straight concert performances. We did some wonderful concerts with Ezra-Pekka Salonen a couple of weeks ago, the sacred music of Stravinsky, which used the hall in just such an unusual way, moving around the stage, creating a sort of atmospheric lighting in the building, using different parts of the stage for different kinds of music. It was a relatively simple but very beautifully effective, and it almost turned the hall into a kind of a church where different sacraments were happening in different places in the church. You can then look at all the dramatic productions we've done in the hall, the Mozart da Ponte operas, which were designed by Frank Gehry. You can look at things we've done this year. We did an amazing performance of Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde in conjunction with a Chilean-based cinema theater company called Teatro Cinema, where the actors acted inside a kind of almost like a almost inside how to describe this, inside a movie screen.
Mm-hmm.
So it turned the performance of Mahler's dramatic work into almost like you were sitting in a movie theater watching the singers inside the screen. There's tremendous willingness to try things that are on the edge. And the thing I love about the organization is the organization has a very high tolerance for doing things that don't work.
Yeah, that's
it's
great.
It's a high tolerance for risk. Most of it works. Some of it doesn't. This is great because what it really tells you is it's an organization which really culturally embraces learning and thinking differently.
It really does. And in taking that risk too, it has very high standards. People sometimes think, oh, you just take a risk. No, be able to take that risk, you have to meet a certain set of standards. But if it fails, you get up, you dust yourself off, and you go on to the next thing. You know, you've also been a leader in melding the artistic with social justice and education and other contemporary issues of concern. How do you embed that into these performances?
Well, look, we're in a very interesting time in the arts right now, where I think that we are challenged beyond how we've ever been challenged before to think about what is our impact on what is our social impact, and how can we play a role in social justice. And for me, you know, as I've thought long and hard about this over the years, and for me, one of the worst things you can do is create false choices. And so I'm a you know, I constantly describe myself as a kind of conservative progressive in the sense that I'm absolutely not willing to talk down our extraordinary centuries-long tradition of a beautiful art form which people find inspiring, you know, year after year. Every year somebody new in our concert hall hears a Beethoven symphony for the first time. Many people do. And you know, that music in our tradition will go on reinvigorating and talking to audiences in new ways for centuries. I have no doubt about that, no interest in apologizing for that. That said, I think that we are in a moment where we can and must think differently about how we bring our art form to the broadest audience, how we change some of the dynamics of exclusivity, which have unfortunately permeated classical music, particularly over the years. When you look at, and you know, the most obvious example of that is conductors. You look at, you know, conducting as a profession was an almost entirely male profession until 20 years ago, and still you have orchestras today producing seasons with all male conductors. It is changing, and the LA Phil is at the front of that changing. And we make a very, very big attempt, to the greatest extent we can, to create gender parity in our conductor roster, which is
Racial equity as well. And a lot of that's reflected in your centennial season. Give us an example of how that shows up there.
Well, we commissioned 50 new works for the centennial, and about a third of them were by composers of color. So, you know, this is a major commitment on our part to think about, you know, who are those composers who can bring different voices. And you know, I think it's worth saying, you know, there's one kind of way of looking at it, which is a moral imperative. And there's another way of looking at it, which is just about thinking about how it enriches our world and our lives. And the truth of the matter is that the great thing about racial equity and diversity when you get inside it in the arts is how profoundly enriching it is for us, how profoundly enriched we are by hearing composers who come from a different background than a traditional white European background, and what they can say to us, how they can inform the way we think, and how they can give us, you know, different experiences. So I regard it as a very joyous aspect of the work we do, not as a moralistic aspect.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I think so many organizations sometimes think that they're required to do it and are trying to hit some kind of quota or some kind of standard, but it really are the ones who believe this will make us that much better.
Absolutely.
That embrace it and really succeed.
And we think it makes us, makes us much better if we have diverse staffs and we have diverse boards and we have a diverse orchestra. And so, you know, those things are all very important to us, especially in Los Angeles. I mean, Los Angeles County is about only about 30% white, and so, you know, the kind of, you know, the impetus to really think hard about these issues is you know, stronger there than maybe anywhere.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, a lot of that plays out in a program of yours that was inspired by El Sistema, which is a famous youth orchestra program in Venezuela. Yours is called YOLA, which is the Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles. Tell us about YOLA, its significance to the L.A. community, and the significance of it to your institution.
Well, I'll start with the last part of that. YOLA is, unlike some education programs and community programs in other arts organizations, which are sort of ancillary and off to the side, YOLA truly is part of the core and the heart and soul of our organization. And you talk to anybody in our organization, any board member, any staff member, they're going to tell you that. It is something that matters deeply to us. It came 10 years ago when Gustavo came to the LA Phil. As you say, it's based on the El Sistema model that he grew up in Venezuela. It's an after-school model. It's an after-school training and performance model. And it really has as its goal, I would say, social goal. Now, it creates great musicians, but if you go back to the roots of El Sistema, it's really fundamentally about healthy families and communities.
Yeah.
And so we never lose sight of that. The program
is about training young musicians. We have four different sites within LA so far, and we're just about to open our fifth site, which is the new Yola Center in Inglewood, which is a new building designed by Frank Gehry with acoustics by Yasu Toyota.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's, and that'll open in 2020.
Yeah, yeah. And these kids do great, I see. 100% of them graduate high school, 90% go on to college, 50% continue to study music. I mean, the numbers are fantastic.
The numbers are fantastic, and it's so, I mean, it's gratifying beyond belief. You know, just now we were on tour with the orchestra in Korea and Japan. And when we go on tour these days, I mean, this is a sign of how core Yola is to the way we think. When we go on tour these days, we take Yola kids with us on tour. These are some young people who've probably never been outside. Many of them have never been outside the U.S. So this year we had 18 Yola students with us in Korea. And during that period, they were learning about which colleges they were going to get into, and so they were you know, day by day sharing their experiences, and they are going on to great things. And what's interesting about it now is the program is 10 years old, and so the program is now coming into that mature moment where kids who started in elementary school are now going into college, so. You know, you're beginning to now really be just at the beginning of the point of where we'll start to make an impact on the profession. And, you know, I'm looking forward to the moment when the kids come out of Oberlin and Juilliard and UCLA and all the other places they are and actually find their way into major American orchestras. And then that will be, you know, a sign that the program has come to full maturity.
Oh, for sure. Dudamel will get a little bit older and one of these kids will take his place.
And that would be a great thing to happen.
Let me ask you a little bit more about that in terms of the arts and music in the tapestry of the U.S. right now, in schools and education. You know, you and I know it's usually the first thing to go. How do you think about that? Do you see that changing, or is it still going to be jettisoned when budgets get tight?
Well, I think, look, I have no doubt about the power of arts about the power of arts in a portfolio of, you know, educational subjects in curriculum, and I think it is one of the most distressing things that I've seen happen in recent years. There will be many people who don't like me saying this, but one of the most distressing things for me has been STEM, and I see people talking about STEM, and I understand the significance about it. I understand the journey that it leads directly into jobs. But the fact is, STEM for me means marginalization of the humanities, and I think that we do that as a civilization at our very, very great risk. And we've seen it happening in schools. We've seen the marginalization of all the humanities, not just about the arts, but all the humanities being marginalized in schools. We've seen how difficult it is for universities to keep humanities program open against the influx of pressure and funding coming in for STEM programs. And I think we have to fight against it. And part of what we're doing with Yola, which I think is really interesting, is we have an amazing research program going on with the Brain and Creativity Institute at University of Southern California. And what is actually coming through this research program is not only about the kind of the way in which arts education sort of informs you as a human being, informs your richness of experience as you go out in the job world, but it actually concretely impacts the way young people's brains develop and the way the neurons connect in their brains and the way they come out wired or not, depending on whether they've had arts education. So for me, this sort of double argument about the sheer neurological impact of arts education side by side with this humanistic benefit of arts education on kids as they go into the workplace, those two, we have to just get much sharper about the way in which we talk about those things, because this really matters for us as a society.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. And you got the goods. You got the data. It's not soft.
Absolutely.
It's really hard data, and it's not a one-off study.
No.
It's been just a series of things that have shown that. You know, I had the great pleasure to go out and visit your offices in February when I was in Los Angeles. And I'd have to say that one of my biggest takeaways was how collaborative everybody was. And by that, I just don't mean internally. That collaboration really extended beyond your four walls and out into the community. Mm-hmm. What makes this culture such a collaborative one?
Well, I think that LA Phil has long had a culture of thinking about itself as a family. And many organizations talk about that. Very few organizations actually deliver on it. It is an organization with high trust among its internal constituencies, between the musicians and the management and the board, and that produces a certain kind of alignment. I think everybody knows what the organization stands for and where it's going. For me, you know, since I came a year ago, I've been particularly interested in opening up some of the processes internally to get us thinking about how we really do allow everybody's creativity to develop and to grow.
Or you're known for an open door policy.
Yeah, absolutely. I have an open door policy, absolutely, for the organization and for the community. But I think it's not only about that. It's about also making sure that we are, wherever possible, you know, we're replacing power with empowerment. You know, I'm much more interested in people following, you know, having the freedom to develop their own, you know, professional journeys than I am in a very rigid hierarchical environment of decision making. So I've tried to promote that over the last year, and I think people like the freedom that comes with that, because there's, you know, one thing we know about happy workplaces, it's not only about benefits and pay, it's about whether people really feel that they are contributing in a meaningful way to the whole. And I think that that's something that the LA feel, that people really do feel.
Yeah, they all feel they have voice, and that is so important.
Exactly.
As part of the centennial, as with most centennials, there is a big fundraising campaign attached to it. Yours is seeking $500 million. How is it going, Simon, and where are you at?
It's going tremendously well. We're at about $380 million on the $500 million goal, and we expect in due course to blow through that $500 million.
Blow through.
I think that there's no question that we will end up with a bigger number than that. It is, it's due to lots of things. We do have, I will say, whenever you look at any campaign, you have to look at the professionalism of the staff. We do have a tremendous development department, mm-hmm. like one of the most skilled development departments I've worked in. But really, it comes down to the generosity of the community. And I'm talking here about board members. Who, you know, still at this stage in the campaign, a few years into the campaign, you know, we're still getting multi-million dollar gifts from board members, in some cases second and third gifts. So, you know, we have a board that is dedicated to the most extraordinary degree to this organization. I've rarely met a board which is so passionate about the organization. I mean, they just love and deeply care for the LA Phil, for what it stands for, and for its people. And so the generosity has been remarkable. And, of course, it goes outside the board. You know, Los Angeles is a very, very big community.
Yeah.
So it is a place where you can go big. You know, it's interesting because LA always had a reputation for being people always said, oh, well, LA, it's philanthropically, well, it's not New York. You know, I heard a lot of people say that.
San Francisco, or Silicon Valley.
And it may not be New York. But it's still pretty amazing.
Yeah,
it's a pretty amazingly generous community. I've been kind of blown away by the level of philanthropy there. And
it also helps that you're part of the community. You're not an institution just sitting up on a hill. You're really embedded in that community.
We are. And we're an organization, I think, for which people have immense respect. I mean, I think we really are regarded as a, you know, really a symbol of what is great about the arts in LA. And as we think about that, you know, I'm always concerned to make sure that, you know, while we do sit on that kind of pinnacle of artistic institutions, it matters to me greatly also that we are accessible. And, you know, as we're coming into the last phases of the campaign, you know, I never want to minimize the importance of the person who makes a $50 gift or the person who makes a $100 gift because, you know, some of those, you know, grassroots supporters are people, some of the most passionate music lovers in our community. And, you know, it takes a village. And so, you know, as an organization, I think, you know, we have to have not only great pride in our status, but also, you know, the humility to be able to recognize and say thank you to the huge number of people who make it possible.
For sure. Now, the actual Centennial Day is October 24th this year, which also happens to be UN Day. It's the same day that the United Nations was founded. Is there anything special that you have planned for that day?
We have, on that day, we have our big Centennial Gala. We bookended the Centennial in two galas, one in the fall of 2018.
Right, with Katy Perry.
With Kate, that's right. That was the Katy Perry. Well, there was two, actually.
Right.
There was one with Katy Perry, which was at the Hollywood Bowl, and then there was a downtown gala celebrating the spirit of California, which was in Walt Disney Concert Hall. And then the other end of the bookend is the gala on October 24th, where we have our three music directors who are still around, Gustavo Dudamel, Esa-Pekka Salonen, and Zubin Mehta. Very sadly, we don't have Andre Previn, who passed away, you know, just this year. But those three conductors will be there. They'll all be conducting music which is dear to their hearts. And most interestingly, they will be all conducting together in a piece for three conductors by Icelandic composer Daniel Bjarnason. And you'll probably ask me, what are the three conductors going to do on the stage? And my answer is, I have no idea. We will find out.
Well, you have to
but there will be three conductors, and they will be conducting the same piece.
Well, you have to leave us with a little bit of suspense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me close with this, Simon. You know, there's always discussion of what a 21st century orchestra is going to look like. And we're still pretty early in the century, and I think that's still a work in process. But the LA Philharmonic is probably further along than anyone else in defining it. So at this moment, what do you believe the 21st century orchestra is going to look like?
Well, as I said earlier, first and foremost, we will always play Beethoven and Mahler and Shostakovich and Bach and Mozart. And that is, and changing that is what it isn't going to look like. And that is, so I'm, you're never going to find me wanting to stray from the, you know, that this extraordinary legacy.
You're a traditionalist when it comes to the art form.
Well, I am, and I'm actually, yeah, I am a traditionalist in the sense that I think that, you know, you know, I think sometimes in our world we can be a bit disparaging about those works. We sometimes hear people talking about Beethoven symphonies as like, oh, war horses, oh yes, the old chestnuts and everything. Well, okay, fine. I don't go into the Metropolitan Museum and go into the, you know, staggering room of Rembrandts and say, oh, it's those old war horse, those old Rembrandts again, do I? But yet, you know, the classical music business has sort of uniquely found a way over the years to kind of become blasé and sometimes disparage its traditions. So first of all, I think it's worth saying, no, we're not going to do that. That is always going to be at the heart of what we do. But I think it is a completely false choice to think that we cannot, as we do that, as we nurture this beautiful history, really make sure that we are there for all the community. Make sure that we are there for young people. Make sure that we are thinking progressively about how people can come to the music we play in whatever way is appropriate to them, about how we reflect the diversity of our society, about how we celebrate sexual orientation, how we celebrate race, how we celebrate difference. And I think as we build on these great traditions, celebrating difference is, and celebrating humanity and its vast richness that we see in 21st century society. That, to me, is one of the great things that the arts can do, which almost nothing else can do.
Sounds like an exciting future. Well, Simon Woods, the Chief Executive Officer of the LA Philharmonic, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For people outside of the Los Angeles area, is there any way they can experience some of the activities that will be occurring this centennial year?
Well, one of the things we did during the centennial, which has been tremendous, is we have a beautiful book, which is called LA Phil Past Forward, which you can purchase, which is a history of the orchestra and also a look at the future, what the future looks like. We have a 32 CD set, which has come about as a result of our partnership with Deutsche Grammophon Records. It's a fantastic box set, including some real treasures, the first recording at the Hollywood Bowl back in the 1920s, some archived things that have never been released before. So that's absolutely a treasure. And then, of course, you know, it's all available for streaming. There's an Apple Music homepage where you can listen to a lot of LA Phil recordings. And finally, we're on the road. I mean, this year we've already been in Seoul and Tokyo. Next stop in the summer is Edinburgh. Which is fun for me because that's where I worked in Scotland for 6 years.
Right.
So it's going to be great to be in Scotland with the orchestra. And then and then in the fall, Mexico City, London, Boston, and Lincoln Center here in New York. So it's many opportunities to hear this great orchestra.
Well, you can count on me being up at Lincoln Center when you arrive.
Great.
Thank you, Simon. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks, Denver. Great pleasure to talk with you. Thanks.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.